much more experience in actually getting out there and physically cleaning up the beaches. Some of the most common techniques are flushing and collecting the oil that flushes off the beach. However, I caution you, it's going to be a race against time. We've seen concentration of oil in certain beaches, and now as the waves and the winds start working on that oil on the shoreline, it's going to even spread even further. So each day it goes further on, we're going to see more and more oil at shoreline. It won't be as heavy as it was, or it is now. It'll get less and less going through time. Yes?
Earlier tonight that they plan to leave Prince William Sound beaches the way they found them. Is it realistic to expect that especially these gravel beaches can be thoroughly cleaned up so that there will not be a continuance of the release of the toxins and that the beaches essentially aren't going to remain oily? I don't see that that's physically possible.
What we have is a system of man-induced cleanup, and that'll take care of some beaches. However, we all know it's very difficult to clean at least 60 miles of beach within a reasonable amount of time. Fortunately, along many of the shorelines, there's a natural cleansing process that'll rework the gravel beaches and fairly rapidly remove the oil from those beaches. If we get a storm here in the next couple of days, which could happen any time, you'll see a rapid removal of oil along many of the shorelines. The sheltered coves and the pocket beaches tucked back from out of the wave action, that's where this oil is going to stay. And that's why we're setting priorities. What will happen on the long term, I've seen it turn into an asphalt pavement either along the upper part of the beach or asphalt fragments on the shoreline.
What effect do you expect this to have on the deer that are all over Night Island and also the bears? The deer will be giving birth to their fawns here shortly, and they traditionally head straight to the beaches. What do you expect to be happening to the deer, and what do you expect to be happening to the bear who traditionally wander the beaches?
I don't want to beg off the question, but I'm not able to answer it. Maybe I can pass it off to somebody else in the group up here. Sure.
Let's first talk about aging of the oil. I understand it's taken on quite a different consistency today. Could you talk about that a little bit?
It picks up a lot of water content to it. I've been trying, I brought a sample back to hopefully get an analysis of the water content within it. It turns to a mousse, an oil and water emulsion. And that can be anywhere from 50 to 70% water in it. So if you start out with 30,000 tons of spilled oil, you now have 60,000 tons if it goes into a relationship of that sort, of GOP to clean up. It makes it harder. I don't know if we have a number yet on the mousse value.
How do you pick stuff like that up?
How do you pick it up? Well, shovels, manpower, flushing, and sorbent boom, a lot of sorbents.
Somebody said
pumps.
The kind of thing you can handle with a front-end loader, and I've been trying to picture it for 2 days now.
I don't think that's reasonable. I think that'd be quite difficult, and it's so isolated. We can't even get a helicopter or float plane in a lot of the places.
It's the way it's described to me, and I have not been there and seen it. It's starting to sink like it's.
That's correct. It'll penetrate into the beach. It's now down, and the upper part is down about 7 inches, 5 to 7 inches, depending on the grain size of it. If it's well sorted, if it's a nice cobble, solid cobble beach, you can imagine this oil, like crankcase oil, just percolates into the beach. And it can go deeper than that and be harder to remove.
We heard tar balls being talked about. Is it at the tar ball stage?
Yes, so. I've really looked at the heavy concentrations of the ones that I've been interested in, because the tar balls from the air, like so many observations have made, you can't see even tar balls on the beach. We're really looking at large concentrations of black banding along the shoreline, places where we're going to, where we can recommend to go next for cleanup operations.
Less toxic as time goes on. Did the toxic fractions continue to remove themselves from it? Is this lessened by the way it goops up?
I'm not quite sure if it lessens the toxicity because of the water incorporation. I don't think so. It's more because the volatiles evaporate off of it. But I'm not a chemist.
We're talking about like enough of this to significantly pave a lot of miles of beach.
Right. The damage would be caused in many cases by smothering if it gets the entire intertidal. Now there is, for in terms of ecological damage, it's interesting that most of this oil, as you know, oil floats, so it comes in on the high tide, gets smeared on the beach, and it'll pass over the lower intertidal. So the lower intertidal is where we have most of our organisms, our encrusting barnacles, our polychaetes, our crabs, and other associated organisms. So fortunately for that situation, then they'll be protected.
And oil, now that it has hit the beach, we're at fairly moderate tides right now.
Right.
We're not in the minus tides that are hitting the tide flats, but in a week, we're going to have over 15-foot tides that will take it up into the salt marsh and up into the higher ends of salmon streams, as well as the minus tides that will take it into the clam beds and the mud flats. Once that oil has hit, is the consistency staying there, or will it, and I know that will change. I mean, if it gets wave action, it would move up, but on those quiet bays,
off of it, and it will be thrown in the upper intertidal. Now, it's very, it won't go to the lower intertidal except if another oil, a large glob comes in there, and it's very possible there's a lot of oil out there yet on the water surface.
But if it's a calm bay and there isn't wave action, is that oil pretty much sticking to the beach and not going to be moved up into the estuary area?
We have onshore winds. If the winds turn around and go offshore, it'll lift off. For the most part, oils will still float at this stage yet, go offshore and hit the beach across the way.
And on the rocky shores, I know the currents tend to drop things on the beaches and not on the, and carry them somewhat.
Exactly.
Is that what you're seeing outside of the massive heavy hit areas of the rocky shores?
The rocky shores come down to the water. There's a wave reflection sets off against the coast and holds the oil offshore.
So you're not seeing, I mean, the rocky shores are covered with mussels and barnacles and snails and algae. You're not seeing that getting just matted down at this point.
Historically, they've been the least impact area, plus the most difficult to clean and the least focus for us at this moment.
From the air, you know, we look at these beaches, and everybody talks about beaches, and it's the rocky shores that are more critical at time because of the tide, correct?
No, I disagree.
I
do look at the rocky shore. I certainly do. And on the case of the rocky shore, you can look at either oil directly hitting the coast, and you'll also see a black band across it, a very distinct bathtub ring. And you can see that when you get into sheltered rocky areas where you have very productive communities. Now, that is a problem there. There are some areas that have been hit in sheltered rocky rather than these exposed cliffs.
There'll be a lot of problems with those the extremes of the tides coming up here in about a week?
I don't think it'll be a, you know, it's a natural system. I'm being yanked off the stage here, so I'll.
Let's go on to the one other speaker before we open the general questions. Chuck O'Clair, talking about the intertidal zone effects and assessment.
My name is Chuck O'Clair. That's O'Clair, and I'm with the National Marine Fisheries Service at Auk Bay. And over the course of years past, we've had approximately 9 sites in Prince William Sound and Port Valdez that we've sampled, I believe a total of 5 years ending in 1981. We've been doing hydrocarbon analysis of sediments and mussels, and John Kernan has been in charge of that project. I've been more or less on the biological end, just developing some baseline data on intertidal organisms, and we came back for the spill, of course, because we had this information from prior years. We wanted to get more information on baseline before the spill hit some areas, because we don't know what sorts of petroleum hydrocarbons have accumulated in organisms and sediments in the intervening years since 1981. The stage that we're at now is that we have in the main sound 5 sites. The other 4 sites were in Port Valdez. Those sites that we've sampled so far, the probability of most of them getting oil, just looking at the trajectory of the spill, is not great. And so what we're trying to do now is expand our area and look and try to get ahead of the spill into areas where the spill will be coming to sample hydrocarbons and organisms there. That's about the stage that we're at now. We haven't attempted to do any evaluation of the effects of oil yet. We're still trying to stay ahead of the spill to get sites that we can use in the future to evaluate the effects. And that's about it.
Over the area over that side of the sound at all?
No. Well, we have the
run over there real quick.
We have a site at Constantine Harbor on Hinchinbrook and in Olson Bay. Those are the only 2 sites we have on that side of the Prince William Sound. If the winds do change, we'll frantically head in that direction. But to date, those are the only two sites we have there. Is there no more?
Something about the tanner crab spawning grounds at Bly Island, and isn't this their primary spawning time? And isn't it true in the Bly Reef area that after tanner crab spawn, if I've got this right, that they're spat or that their young float to the surface?
It's a little bit early for tanner crabs to release. They have their little larva is called a zoea. They have several zoeal stages, the last larval stage is a megalops, which settles to the bottom and metamorphoses into a young tanner crab. You're right, the zoea are in the water column in the spring. I think they tend to be, I'm more familiar with king and dungeness crab. The king crab tend to be release their zoea as close in synchrony to the phytoplankton bloom as they can, and it depends upon various factors. Generally, most invertebrates are releasing larvae in the spring, various times. Dungeness crab later on. The tanner crab, I'm not exactly sure what the timing is for that particular species, but you're right, they would be in the water column and fairly near the surface.
One of the local biologists in Cordova had informed me that the Bly Reef area was one of the primary spots for the spawning to take place in Prince William Sound, and that they were indeed going off now. As has been reported, there's numerous plankton blooms going on around the sound at this time. Even on the day that the tanker grounded, there were sightings of plankton blooms. How do you propose, or does the department have the resources to somehow study and analyze this thing? And this is the basis of one of our tanner crab fisheries here in Prince William Sound. How can we ever expect to know what really happens to that fishery because of this oil spill?
Well, I think it's a good question. I think there should be some emphasis placed on that. I've concentrated in Prince William Sound on the intertidal region, and I'm not familiar with the crab fisheries here. And in the future, in the next couple of weeks, try to change our emphasis to a more commercial aspect. But I have to talk with my supervisor on that before we'll start doing that. And I'm not exactly sure what species we'll be concentrating on. Certainly, the fisheries, last Department of Fish and Game, should perhaps consider expanding into this area.
Encourage the department to expand into this area on the behalf of the Cordova District Fishermen United. And I would also like to compliment the Department of FinFish on their excellent communication with the fishermen. It's the only department, no, I can't say that, it is one of the few departments, unlike Exxon, that will communicate with us. And I'd really like to extend my gratitude to the wonderful communication we've had with this department. They are the complete antithesis of what we've got from Exxon.
Could I ask Mr. Mackey a question now, real quickly here? I don't remember the lady's name that was up there earlier, but I'm just wondering, now that we have the location of such large numbers of oil birds, can we anticipate boats being dispatched tomorrow to bring in the numbers of birds that haven't already died and that they will be brought in to be cleaned maybe tomorrow?
As I believe I mentioned earlier, we do have 5 boats out there now. I'm not certain of exactly their trajectory. They will be coordinating with helicopter support to return any retrieved oil animals back to the facility.
I don't know if you were here earlier, but there has been a major communication problem with the boats. We have boats wandering around out in the sound calling in saying, what am I supposed to be doing? And, you know, I'm just wondering if the communication's going to be improved to the point where we can get the boats to the right beaches and get some of these birds back before. Obviously, if they're that oil and there's such a high percentage, they're going to be dying in a hurry.
again, it is a very significant logistical problem. Much of the radio gear on some of the boats isn't up to snuff to be able to reach quite back here. We've implemented a state-of-the-art communication center. There is a portable communication module on the island just off the grounded tanker site to try to facilitate communication. We're currently looking at other systems to try to augment that to ensure we'll have better communication as the cleanup proceeds.
I've been told that it's extremely hard once the birds are oiled to catch them, that they flee and that they're really, really hard to catch, unless they're so oiled that they're probably too sick to save at that point. Are there a number of people on the boats that are qualified and they know how to catch the birds?
Yes, that's exactly why we enlisted the support of Alice Berkner and her staff, because they are experienced.
People there were available.
Well, what they've done is to school each of the boats and the folks on the boats prior to getting out into the sound to try to avoid inexperienced people chasing birds around and possibly causing more damage to the bird than in their efforts to try to help. So by schooling folks and sharing with them the benefit of their experience on technique to catch these birds and mammals, we hope that that'll minimize the impacts.
Okay, thanks for
to address that question regarding phytoplankton earlier, I'd just like to say that a piece of the program we have designed with the input of the state biologist does include the sampling of phytoplankton and zooplankton at a number of stations throughout the sound to get estimates of population density, species composition, and the typical factors we use to define the overall state of health of that population. So it is an important piece of the program that we do have underway in concert with the state agencies.
Mr. Mackey,
I would like to strongly encourage Exxon to put one of their personnel, of which in a corporation of your size, I'm sure you have many, in Cordova, where the majority of the fishing fleet is, so that they can have some direct line of coordination and communication over to Valdez, because there are people there now who would be ready to go out and help with these various recovery programs of the waterfowl and marine life. Unfortunately, we can never seem to get through this barrage of barriers between us and you. I would strongly, strongly suggest you get Exxon personnel located permanently in Cordova so we have an open communication lane.
Certainly, we appreciate that comment. And for your knowledge, there are boats from Cordova that are out in the program. We had some dispatch.
Very few of the numbers that would like to come. I would call that a very...
Yeah, this Schoon's Conference isn't dealing with that question right here. There is a fisherman's command post in the courthouse. Take it up with them, and they can communicate with the appropriate agencies.
Same problem. Is there some sort of number maybe that could be established for people who locate oiled animals to call other than... I mean, the command post number, you better have a redial because it's busy all the time.
I think every telephone in Valdez is that way.
Right. Is there some, maybe, I mean, the phone company's been putting in lines as fast as they can. Could one number maybe be established for reporting oiled animals or for people that want to go assist?
Yes, indeed. We do have numbers. Here's a couple of the extensions, 5152 and 5148. Both of these ring directly in the Animal Rescue Center, and we'll get you in contact with the staff of the center.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for coming to the press conference. We'll probably schedule a press conference in a week, and you can provide evaluation at that time.
Well, we just heard the conclusion of the press conference. It was listed as a NOAA conference, but it was really that under the NOAA umbrella. It was a wide array of state and federal agencies, all of which have some role in the environmental response and the cleanup that's happening or is underway for the waters of Prince William Sound. In one sense, while a lot of specific information or specific numbers were bandied back and forth, coming into the meeting tonight, everyone here knew that there are thousands of birds, thousands of marine mammals in Prince William Sound, that there are 240,000 barrels of oil that have been released into the area, and that there is an impact, probably a severe impact, on the wildlife. At the end of this meeting, we know about the same. We do know some specific points that are of concern, that there was an effort to boom. In fact, there were booms dispatched and set in place around the Needles, an area particularly sensitive to sea lions as a haul-out and a pupping area. That boom was relocated to protect a commercial fishery area. Unless there is an increase in the number of booms and equipment, one might anticipate there could be a growing incident of a conflict between the various rescue and protection priorities that will emerge as the oil continues to move through the western part of Prince William Sound, an area characterized by many islands, fjords, glaciers, hanging glaciers over the water, protected coves, an area that is a rich recreational resource and certainly a rich resource for marine mammals and also for commercial fishing. Probably the high point of the evening here, perhaps not too too discernible via by radio alone, was after the meeting was underway, Dr. Kay Frost, an Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist, or I believe a biologist, came in late, still wearing her survival suit and boots, and probably gave more hard information in her 10 minutes than we had heard all day and all night regarding the specific impact of a specific beach on some specific species. She said she had been looking primarily for marine mammals, but had walked a beach on Green Island. Green Island was an area that had been specifically identified by the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance and other environmental groups as being particularly important to the marine mammal population. There was a walk on the ground today among the people there, Dr. Kay Frost of ADF&G. Her report was of just a shocking impact. Probably 100 birds or more, 80 to 90% of which were heavily oiled. Only two or three birds, she noted, that were actually dead. She did see some otters there. She said about 16, about a third of them, which would be five or six animals, were oiled to some degree or another. She said none of those animals were dead. Another scientist who reported when they landed their float plane, they ran into the carcass of a dead otter. There are animals that are dying. We don't know how many. There is certainly, the report we heard tonight, hundreds of birds that have been seen. Now we have confirmation, thanks to Dr. Frost, that are oiled on the beaches. She also went to great lengths to describe the difficulty in seeing these animals, these oiled birds, even from 50 feet in the air in a helicopter. She says you really must walk the beach. Very little other new information. A lot of specific technical data passed back and forth. We do have an indication that animals such as the harbor seals and the sea lions may be less susceptible to the effects of the oil, that otters may be at grave risk because of they depend on their fur the harbor seals and the otters both depend on their fur for insulation. Animals like the sea lions that depend more on blubber are not as vulnerable. That there is hopes by the scientists that animals such, marine mammals rather, such as the dolphins and the killer whales, the orcas, may not be as susceptible to the physical effects of the oil, although there had been very little discussion about the possible toxic effects of oil ingestion. It has been pointed out by several speakers today and tonight that the toxicity of the hydrocarbons, the oil diminishes as the volatile, the lighter weight, really toxic part elements in the crude oil mix, they are the ones that tend to evaporate. Good news and bad news about beaches. We heard that, you know, that there are beaches that are impacted, that it is ugly, that there's lots of oil there, that some of the other rocky beaches may or may not be so badly affected. There is some hope for many areas of the Sound, but at the same time, a discussion that at least 60 miles of wilderness beaches, gravel beaches, are heavily oiled. At this point, the reconnaissance in the air, on the ground, in the water, still concentrating on the worst hit areas, on the most severely impacted areas. It may be weeks before we know what the actual impact is on the total, even in the areas that are lightly sheened. The NOAA representative hosting this meeting, John John Whitney from NOAA indicated that the next briefing might be as long as a week away, or at least next week. The scientists evidently planning to take their time and do some more exhaustive study before they come back to report with a further update. At the press conference tonight, Dr. Mackey, the Exxon biologist, did take the continuing beating that is being administered to Exxon by fishermen from Cordova and by other locals regarding difficulty in communicating. As we heard today earlier from Don Cornett of Exxon, they in some ways have more assets and they know what to do with. Command and control still seems to be a problem that is plaguing the cleanup effort. While we also hear encouraging things about the positive effects of working groups and joint committees and task forces, we also hear some evidence of lost communications and the difficulty in coordinating the massive number of agencies and departments and industrial groups and contractors and subcontractors who were all involved. Literally the alphabet soup list of agencies involved in this response is staggering. It goes on and on. Exxon itself and the oil industry are compartmented and segmented, and just communications and collating all the information has been an ongoing problem throughout the first 7 days of this incident. Tomorrow, we anticipate there will be an Exxon briefing at 11 in the morning and an Exxon briefing at 6 in the evening. At this time, no other briefings are scheduled. However, we don't often get notice on all of the press conferences that are made. If we hear of any additional meetings or conferences or announcements or statements, we will pass those along to listeners and to stations down the line. At this time, I'd like to thank KCHU staffer Laura Lee, APRN technician Chris Bedalek for their assistance in this broadcast. Back at KCHU, we started this press conference with Jeff Brown, who's assisting us on loan from KTOO Radio in Juneau. I'm not sure who's still on the board. Jeff may well be there. We also have one of our volunteer announcers coming in this evening for KCHU's regular programming. We will again continue broadcasting tomorrow and give you the latest information. I want to thank our listeners for staying with us. There was a lot of detail that had been missing tonight. We heard a lot of scientific information. I think one point that remains clear is that the answers that the press and the public are going to get in the short term are not going to be the answers they're looking for. We're not going to hear any body counts of birds or mammals anytime in the near future. We're going to hear isolated reports. Everybody who flies over the sound sees the part of the sound that they landed in or flew over, and it's a case where every observer sees their snapshot of the picture, and there's no way apparent to put all those snapshots together and come up with a picture of the whole. We did, however, hear some encouraging news for some species, and we heard some bad news for others. There may be definitely some serious problems for migratory wildfowl that are heading this way. There are certainly millions of birds coming to Alaska. Many of them come through Prince William Sound. We don't know how many. Again, good news and bad news tonight. Day 7 is ending, the 7th day of the Exxon Valdez tanker oil spill. Good Friday, a week ago tomorrow. The tanker ran aground in the early hours. Today has been a day of some revelations. We heard this morning that the captain of the Exxon Valdez failed to pass a blood alcohol test administered some 10 or 10 and a half hours after the accident. The Coast Guard regulation stipulates that 0.04% blood alcohol is the maximum, beyond which, actually that is the level, that level and beyond would be illegal for a captain to operate a vessel. The captain, 10 and a half hours after the incident, registered 6.61 in blood alcohol analysis and 0.09 by urine analysis. Later in the day, Exxon announced they had terminated the captain as a result of his obvious violation of policy, refusing to link, however, alcohol as the culprit in the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, saying instead those facts would be brought out by the NTSB investigation. And then tonight we heard the assessment, that this would have to be a preliminary assessment by scientist after scientist saying, we've studied this question, we've made our best guesses, we've written our reports, this is the first time in waters such as this we've seen such a spill, we may have to rewrite our textbooks, no one can really predict And over the next week or so, I think we will see a determined effort from what we have heard tonight to study. They're looking at every aspect of the environment. There are parts of the sound that are not being studied or researched at this point. But wherever the oil spills are heavy, the direction of the oil spill, there seems to be a growing network of teams out searching and digging. So, day seven, I'm Dave Hammack. This is the Valdez Civic Center. We've been listening to a live broadcast of a press conference sponsored by NOAA involving several regulatory agencies.